Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 71 of Registry Matters. Larry, we are almost three quarters of a century old.
I know. Isn't it fantastic that they haven't done anything to us yet?
And they haven't kicked us off the internet.
Well, that's a little bit harder than other things, but I suppose they could do it.
I think that somebody that harasses us, we should tell them that we could get their IP address and we could remove them from our broadcast from our end.
Well, I was hoping we could do that because talk show host Neil Bortz used to tell people that in the day on the radio, that if they didn't like him, that he would disconnect from his end if they would give him the serial number off of the radio.
Now, in your experience, do you think that could possibly work?
I'm not sure that he did anything for other than for entertainment to illustrate the stupidity of a person who says, "I hate you, Neil." They would call in and wait on hold on talk commercial radio. You're waiting on hold forever. And I wait on hold to tell him what a crappy show he had. So he was saying, "Well, I wonder why you stayed on hold 30 minutes to tell me that. Why don't you just give me your serial number from your radio and I'll disconnect you from this side."
Right.
For those who remember, Neil Bortz, he was based out of Atlanta, and he was all over, I forgot how many stations before his retirement, and it's B-O-O-R-T-Z, as in zebra.
He was very entertaining. I enjoyed listening to him.
Did you listen to Neil Bortz?
I have, and then while I was gone, I on occasion could actually pick him up, you know, in the dormitory or whatever, but I would listen to him. He, at a minimum, will make you think about what your stance is on a political ideal. And, you know, you either accept, like, hey, I mean, he's not a stupid individual. He's a smart cat.
He was so entertaining in the earlier days when he was on just a local station, the very small station, WRNG, Ring Radio in Atlanta. And
you've brought up that one before. Yeah.
He had to do anything he could to get controversy going, and he would say some really off the wall stuff. He'd say women can't drive a shopping cart. He would say nothing more reckless than a woman pushing a shopping cart in a grocery store. And of course, the phone lines would light up immediately when you would say something like that. And then he would give the train example about running on the train and jumping, and you could be running with the train or against the train, and people would argue which jump would be longer. And he would light up the phone lines with stuff like that when he ran out of intelligent stuff to talk about. But people would call in droves when he said something really provocative, and that's what he had to do in the days. But as he got more and more stations, then he dropped all of that stuff, much like Rush used to be more entertaining.
I guess at some point you just have the momentum and inertia that you're going to have what would he have? A million listeners, do you think? What did he have in his heyday?
I don't know about Neil. Probably nowhere near as many as Rush has, but he had a huge audience. And at that point, you don't need to light up the phone lines. When you're talking in a local 5,000-watt radio station back in the 60s or early 70s, you had a small audience. And if you didn't have people on the phones and talk radio, you had to do the talking.
Yeah.
And you run out of things to gibber about it. And so that's what he would do to get people provoked into calling.
Well, let's get this thing going. And I will mention, we just got a new patron a handful of days ago, which is pretty exciting. An individual named Jason. So welcome, Jason, coming in at the, I think it is the supported level. Yeah, it's the supported level. That's pretty awesome. Thank you very much for that.
Straight to my bank account.
Yes, the person did not choose net or gross, so I don't know what to tell you about that.
Well,
right. Well, then we have a voicemail message from Will. Will is trying to follow up on a question that he had last week about the, if you recall, lifetime supervision and then trying to move to a different state. And he is a little apologetic, but let's give Will a listen.
Good morning. This is William from Tennessee. I'm just now listening to RM70, and thank you guys for taking my question, and I guess I should have made it a bit more specific. I understand that there are still reporting requirements, even to enforce those specialized parole conditions for sexual offenders. That's what I really should have asked. But thank you for giving an answer. And to all of you out there that support the registry, I think you're all just friendly young people. So have a good day. Thank you. And to those of you, FYP, if you don't support rights for everyone, have a good day.
So we've corrupted Will from saying he has a religious exception from saying FYP, but now Will is saying FYP.
I thought I had answered that, and I'll try to be even more precise and clear. Every condition of supervision that's imposed on you and the state of your conviction follows you. End of discussion. It follows you.
Isn't he asking something along the lines of like special conditions?
Those all follow you.
Okay.
If it's a condition that was imposed on you, not your registration requirements, don't get those two confused. Your conditions of supervision, be it parole or probation, those conditions follow you. The receiving state must enforce those. They have no choice. And I even said that on last week's podcast. Now, of course, we're dealing with human beings. And if you have what they consider to be ridiculously asinine, insane conditions, they may just turn a blind eye to it and say, we're not going to ever violate this person for that. But when that packet comes to the state of Colorado from the state of Alabama, and Alabama says you will get treatment, even if Colorado doesn't require it. If Alabama says you'll be on GPS as a condition of your supervision, Colorado will do it, even though they may not require, in case of Colorado, they do have GPS. But they're obligated to enforce that, or they have to tell the sending state, we cannot, due to our Constitution, or because of lack of technology, or because of a court ruling or something, we cannot enforce that condition. But they are obligated to tell the sending state the conditions that they cannot enforce, and the sending state must either remove them or the person can't go. So your conditions will follow you.
Let's just to give an example. If you move to a state that has pretty low monitoring requirements, and you come in and with all this lifetime monitoring and computer monitoring, GPS monitoring, whatever, and they don't have the facilities to take care of it, you could have your transfer denied. I think that's what
Absolutely.
You're saying, ultimately. Right.
They,
okay.
They could tell the sending state, we don't do that here. Now, I think pretty much all the states have adjusted to GPS, and they've adopted to some level of computer monitoring for sexual offenders, some level of varying levels of it. But otherwise, that condition goes with you. The term of your supervision goes with you, not the term of your registration. People keep blending those together. But the term of your supervision goes with you. Wouldn't it be a fantastic country if you could get a 30-year probation sentence in Georgia and you could move to Idaho and it would go away because they don't believe in that? Wouldn't it be fantastic? How many people would be headed to the other states after that?
Yeah, we've talked about getting stock in U-Haul if that were the case. It does get crazy confusing when you layer on registry requirements of states A and B and then supervision requirements of source and destination state. It gets crazy confusing in figuring out what, at least it is to me and somebody that, you know, I'm new at this. I think I have it down, but, you know, to our new listeners even seasoned listeners, it can be very confusing.
Well, what's your probation or parole or supervision required? The reason why the Interstate Compact refers to them as offenders under supervision because they different states call they have different names. Like in the decision we're going to talk about toward the end of the podcast out of Illinois, that's called mandatory supervised release, but it's a form of supervision. If you're reporting to a supervising officer to do supervision other than your registry obligations, then you're under supervision, and those conditions follow you from state to state.
Right. Well, are you ready to move on to an email message?
Sure.
All right. We have an email message from Nancy. You guys, thank you so much for doing the show. I enjoy every show. And I did a lot of editing on this to trim it down. She sent me War and Peace for an email message. But there is some talk in the community to put a stop to Iowa's exception to registry restrictions on registrants on school property. It's written now that RSOs are allowed to attend their own children's events, school events, with the permission of school administration. Our family has benefited from this for almost 5 years, and it means the world to our kids. I've contacted my local senator, asking him to inform me of any legislation coming through that might strike that exception from the laws. He said, indeed, he has heard something about that in private, but he would not tell me who is proposing it and where it might show up. I've been scouring the legislation page daily, trying to see where someone is going to sneak it in. The senator told me several years ago that it would be career suicide for him to stand up for sex offenders. So I know I can't trust him to inform me. I feel like my hands are tied, trying to fight this ghost. Do you have any ideas about trying to find someone who would know about this potential threat to our children's lives? Would love to visit with you sometime. I'm using my educational career informing my fellow social work classmates in my and my private college about the facts of the registry. Almost all of my research and assignments have to do with that subject. I figure that that is pretty much right in your wheelhouse of trying to figure out how some sort of legislation might sneak in.
Well, if it were to be, I think we had a news clip on one of our podcasts about that, about a person who was given an exemption in
Iowa.
Yes,
I believe so.
And it caused an outburst of anger from the community because of the sexual offender was being allowed on school campus. I believe it was from Iowa.
Yes, that sounds about right.
But if it's just a standalone piece of legislation, where that's all the legislation is going to do, it'll be pretty easy to spot. I'm quite confident Iowa has a website. I believe that the internet does reach into Iowa, so I believe the legislature there would have a website. And most of them are fairly user-friendly. They have keyword searches. So if you're interested in stuff with sex offender, you would use that as one of your keyword searches. And it would tend to find any legislation that has sex offender in it. And you might pop up, if you do a keyword search, you would find what's pending in your legislature. And I don't know anything about when they're in session, how many days a year they run or anything about that. And Iowa, it's never come up on the radar before. But that would be the thing I would encourage you to do is to watch the daily activity on the website if they are in session to see. And then it gets a little deeper than that. If they have interim committees that meet when they're not in session to try to vet legislation that might be presented when they are in session, it'd be worthwhile to try to figure out how to watch those. But there's no easy way. I mentioned to tell that towing story about the towing of cars because there's no magic formula to doing this. It's work. Even the lawmakers that serve her, they're not going to know all. We had 1,300 bills in our 60-day session, and that's just bills. That's not memorials, joint memorials, proclamations, all the different
resolutions, house resolutions, all that kind of silly stuff.
Things that they do. That's just actual bills that were given a House bill or a Senate bill number. But if you got 60 days and you've got 1,300 bills, do you actually think any of those 112 lawmakers are going to know what all 1,300 bills are about? Of course not.
Word for word, they have them all memorized.
So, and anybody who tells you that they don't vote on anything that they haven't read, what you need to do is run as quickly as you can because everybody votes on stuff they haven't read. You can't possibly read it all.
Right. Well, we could go back like the Obamacare thing, whatever it was. It was like 1,500 pages and no one had read, like, we're just going to have to figure out what's in it when it gets passed or if it doesn't get passed. We'll just have to figure it out and play it by ear as we go through.
Well, theoretically, staffers and the key committees had reviewed it in great detail, but the individual lawmakers who weren't intricately involved, they weren't reading that 800, 900, 1,200, whatever it was, pages. You can't. But yeah. In our legislature, we have concurrent resolution, joint resolution, resolution, joint memorial, and memorial, plus bills. And right. Like I said, just the bills was 1,300 pieces of legislation. You don't know all that stuff. So you can be the best of friends with lawmakers, and they're going to tell you the same thing that I'm telling you. You're going to need to brush up on watching it or either hire a lobbyist. And I doubt that most of our listeners are going to be able to hire their own lobbyist.
Are there any services that would act as a medium in between? Like, I know that there's CQ roll call, but that is ridiculously expensive. Do you think you could build any sort of searches then and save them and have them automatically trigger looking for these 10 kind of key phrases? So sex offender, sexual offenses, you know, can do you think that could be done to somehow alleviate the strain?
well, you're the tech geeky. I don't know.
If you could,
I know that once you identify, you can have a build tracking list here, which is helpful if you see the builds as they're moving where they are, and it lets you know when you need to be at a key spot in the process. But as far as following the daily introduction of builds with keywords, I don't know that our system is set up the way. I know I don't. If that is a feature that we have, I don't use it. I do it the old-fashioned way. I go during the introduction period, which is the first half of the session. So the 30-day right. session and 60-day session, there's 30 days. And a 30-day session is 15 days. I go on the daily build tracker and I see what was introduced and I read it by title and I see if it thinks I think it might have something juicy in it. And then right. I open right, up right, the build. Right. But that's what I do. And then I do keyword searches all the time, looking for keywords, and sex offender is going to appear in a lot of stuff.
I know. But it also ends up to be almost something that's not even related. They'll just say the word and it has nothing to do with any sort of proposal. And it's almost, you know, it's a red herring. It's a false positive is what I'm going
to
say.
Well, it'll be, look, I'm just going to do sex offender real quick on our website to see how many bills had that in there. But it was
out of 1300. And then you have to take the time and go read them and process the words. And you know, it's a little bit tedious and it's written in legalese and you just have to fight through it. Right.
So we had 19 bills that had sex offender come up.
That's not so. that doesn't feel like that would be an insurmountable thing to try and keep track of.
No. So, sure. anything. And one of them was two of them were, so really 17 bills.
Okay.
Things like driver's license changes, uniform collateral
right.
conviction.
Right, things like that. That's what I'm referring to where, you know, and they, I guess they would impact us because if they're going to change the driver's license things, I want to, yeah, because the voicemail that I'm about to play is about driver's license stuff where they're, you know, normal people have to register every 10 years, but our people might only, you know, they have to register every year or 2 years, something like that. They do impact us. All right, so here's a voicemail from George.
Hello, gents. My name is George, I'm from Michigan. I had a conviction in 05 and a misdemeanor, and then was able to have it expunged in 2014. Somebody that you know of in Michigan that perhaps is fighting this particular situation, I'd love to know any detail there might be on it. So thank you for all you do, and FYP, thank you.
It's catching on, Larry.
Catching on, I'm glad. There are a number of states that do that. They make the exception for you have an expungement, but the registration, since it's a civil regulatory scheme, they tell you that you still have to register. But the effect of that is, since the registry is public in most instances, the effect of that is it causes the conviction to live on, in addition to the prohibitions and exclusions of what you're allowed to do and all the discrimination that flows from it. But yes, there are other states that do that. Florida does it for sure, and I know it's not that uncommon. I think Texas does it, and there is some litigation in Michigan. Unfortunately, I do not believe that this case is going to be successful. Although I do love the arguments that the attorney made, he just made some strategic judgments that I think are going to be counter to his cause as he goes through it. Now, I hope I'm wrong. When I say these kind of things, I hope I'm wrong. But he did not bring a declaratory judgment for the guy. He brought a petition for removal from the registry. And the guy was not eligible because his offense was not one of those that would permit him to be removed from the registry under Michigan's removal process after 25 years, I believe it is. So therefore, he's appealing something where there was no jurisdiction for the court to grant it to begin with. If you don't have subject matter jurisdiction, it strikes me as very odd. You could have an appeal that would be worth very much, because if the court didn't have subject matter to grant you the relief, how could your appeal go forward? That's to me, it just goes with it. That's law 101. You got to have subject matter jurisdiction. But he's got fantastic claims, as far as I'm concerned, which he ties with the Homeless Useful Trainee Act, which the person who made the call will understand that the under the Homeless Useful Trainee Act, which Michigan increased the age now to 26, you can be eligible. And if you get granted that status, which was the Zach Anderson situation out of the guy from Indiana that went into Michigan and hooked up with an underage girl that made so much publicity a couple of years ago, a few years ago.
He
fussed because he wasn't granted the HITA status, HYTA, and he managed to get a second bite at the apple, and he got that status designated to him on the second go round. But the attorney's making the argument that a set aside amounts to essentially the same thing as the HYTA, and I tend to agree with him. So there is litigation in Michigan, and if this particular case is not successful, I believe that it would be worthwhile for that issue to continue to be litigated, and we would be interested in that litigation at NARSL at some point, but we would like to see the litigation presented correctly from the get-go so that you don't get extinguished on jurisdictional grounds.
Very, very interesting. Okay. You ready to hit these articles? We got some juicy stuff going down. All right. To all you conservative right-wing nutjobs out there, we have an article from the Charles Koch Institute. This is in your favor, though. I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 episodes we covered something along those lines. But the title of this is, it's a new survey. Consumers overwhelmingly endorse businesses that employ people with criminal records. Larry, what is your feeling of the general public in hiring people with records? Do you think that this is accurate? Is this cherry-picking data?
I believe it's both, probably. I believe it is accurate, except for the emotional offenses. We have a couple of categories of crimes that are very emotionally charged, and sexual offenses is one of them. I bet if you were to take the same poll with the exact same people and said, well, now you just got through saying that. Now, does that apply to sex offenders? I bet you would probably get a different answer.
Yeah, you would be like, yeah, we should do that for these people. Oh, wait, but no, not those people.
But all you have to look at to validate that is look at the when they start doing criminal justice reform. Look who gets cut out first.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they cut out murder and sex offense.
And even murderers have a better chance of surviving the cut than sex offenders. But DWI, domestic violence, and sex offense, those are probably the most emotional charged crimes. Yeah. So there's not as much tolerance and forgiveness. Drug addicts, although I think alcohol is a drug, right?
Last time I checked.
People who are ingesting other substances even get more slack than people who drive drunk. That's emotional, and then domestic violence. And I'm not saying these things should not be emotional. I'm not justifying, but I'm saying that I just don't believe that you'd get the same vote tally if you said,
yeah,
and this applies to sex offenders as well.
Yeah. And, but just to dig in a little bit deeper, some of the other key findings, there's like one half of those surveyed said they feel comfortable buying goods or services from businesses if a customer facing employee has spent 5 or more years in prison. And I wonder then if the person's got sleeve tattoos and all, you know, piercings in their face, you know, they just had a rough time in prison. I don't know that those people are accepted very well publicly facing.
It does. Of course, old people like me, it does create some consternation when I see a walking tattoo with screws and bolts and chains and everything.
And I say that, and as the words were coming out of my mouth, somebody listening, and I was like, oh yeah, her husband has sleeves. And I was like, yeah, oh man, where am I going? I got to get my foot out of my mouth quick.
But back to the sex offender thing, if we just eliminated, if we stopped having people that we referred to as sex offenders, if we just simply had offenders, that problem would go away, wouldn't it?
I think so.
When we started having sex offenders and making them a different class of offenders, that's the problem, a big part of the problem. We have a separate group of offenders. And if we just didn't have that, I suspect that if we didn't ask the person, how do you feel about sex offenders? If we could just contain it to how do you feel about offenders? I think those numbers are probably valid. But the fact that we have a group that we call sex offenders makes it very emotional for people.
And then 3 in 4 Americans feel comfortable buying goods or services from those who give second chances, which, I mean, you know, that's better. So somebody can work in the back of the factory or the warehouse or whatever, and they don't mind buying a product from them. But it doesn't indicate, I don't think in the article anywhere, that they wouldn't be encouraged. They wouldn't be like, oh, I'm going to buy this product over that because of their criminal justice reform stance. They're just saying, yeah, I don't really care. It doesn't bother me.
That's a strong number. 3 in 4.
It is.
That is significant. I mean, how often do you see 75% approval on things?
On anything? No. It's pretty hard to find that. We can just move on from that, though. This Larry, this is totally, this has got me so enraged. This is like making me visibly shake. There's some recent stuff that has gone up to the highest court, to our SCOTUS justices. And there's this individual from, where is he from? It's Michigan, Iowa. Where is he from? Oh, man.
Michigan doesn't have a death penalty, so I don't think it'd be Michigan.
Well, it couldn't be there. I'll find it eventually. This is a man who has some crazy kind of medical condition that he claims that when he is put to death by lethal injection, that he will have an excruciating amount of pain. And he tries to, you know, it goes through all the processes and the whole thing gets to the Supreme Court. And our wonderful new, one of our new Supreme Court justices, Neil Gorsuch, has thrown out saying cruel and unusual punishment, talking about how things were when the country was founded. It only, you know, hanging someone would be extremely painful. But if you were then to intensify the pain, that would be what would constitute cruel and unusual punishment. So this guy can be put to death and go through pain. We just can't make it painerful.
Well, I mean, but see, that's... When I go on these tangents, I do about people who believe with all their heart that they are conservatives and they believe in strict construction. This is exactly an example of that. If you hold to that rigid ideology that society is not an evolving standard of decency, which is a philosophy of the Warren Court. If you believe that you only look at how the founders would have interpreted and what they would have meant, Gorsuch is exactly right. It was, executions were very painful, and that was not considered cruel and unusual. So to say that this man in Missouri is going to have to experience some pain, that does not magically make capital punishment cruel in any way. He's not entitled. If you're an originalist, he's not entitled to a pain-free experience. Now, if you believe, like the liberals believe, that society evolves and our standards of how we treat ourselves and how we take care of animals and how we respond evolve as we mature and grow, that we would go out of our way to avoid inflicting pain when someone's being put to death, if we still are obsessed on putting them to death, then that's the different perspective. But the Constitution doesn't guarantee you that if you're an originalist.
So this guy is in Missouri, by the way. I had the M right. I just couldn't remember. It's Missouri, not Michigan.
Yeah, yeah. But so like I say, if you buy into that doctrine, and so many of our listeners think, I mean, I've had them tell me by the dozens, oh, I'm a conservative, I'm originalist, I don't believe in all this mumbo jumbo. I said, okay, well, just like you got the strict construction of the Nebraska statute that the Nebraska Supreme Court ruled on. If you are an originalist and you don't believe we evolved, then Gorsuch did exactly the right thing. As far as him saying that it's not his problem that execution is painful. It's not for him to decide that they should look for less painful ways. That's for the state to decide their method of execution and what their alternatives might be if the person has a medical condition. I'm not the one that's supposed to impose my decency standards on you. You guys, as you evolve as a society, you make your laws and you decide how you want to treat one another. Don't look to me. I mean, that's an originalist. That's a limited justice.
And this guy isn't even asking for a stay of execution. He's asking to be put to death by...
carbon,
nitrogen.
Yeah. Well, that would do the job.
That would totally do the job. No, he's asking for by gas, which they just, I guess they just take the oxygen out of the air and you suffocate. Not to go in the gruesome details of it, but they do, it's a nitrogen gas thing. So he's like, hey, you can still knock me out, but you know, can you do it this way instead of that way? I can't quite grasp the idea of why you would say, no, F you, you get to die by this way because we're assholes.
Well, but you don't believe in an activist judiciary, do you?
I don't know that I have a stance on that.
You wouldn't want the people who were not elected by anyone, in the case of federal judges, wouldn't want them circumventing the will of the people and inserting their belief doctrines into it of how an execution should take place. You wouldn't want to substitute what the people have decided through their elective process, would you?
So the people of Missouri elected the people that made capital punishment a thing, and in that same process, it was determined how it would be taken out?
Usually, the means of execution are defined in the statute of how okay. an execution will take place. And if the people of Missouri want a backup plan, right. they can right. get it to the lawmakers and say, we want you to have alternate means of execution for people who might experience pain if that's their value. I doubt very many people care about people experiencing pain.
No, I bet you not.
What they would say is that you ought to thought about the pain when you did that, when you inflicted the pain, because most people on death row have been convicted of a murder. And most of the time when you take a life, it's not pleasant. I think we could all agree on that.
Yeah. The other...
When you take someone's life, it's usually not through something pretty.
Right. Yeah, of course. And because of the three cocktail drug has been like there's a ethical stance, a moral stance of the companies that have made it. They've said, no, we're not going to support this anymore. So now the United States can't get the lethal injection drugs. So they have resorted to these other means, including, if I'm not mistaken, firing squad has been reinstituted in some places. I could have that kind of blown out of proportion.
I think it has. Yes.
So to me, this then leads us, and I don't have the article in there, but it's something I want to talk about. So there were two cases recently, Larry, where there was a case with a Muslim, and he asked to have his imam in the execution chamber, and they denied the case. And then there's another one that a Buddhist wanted to have his priest, forgive me on the right term for the high religious figure, and they accepted that one. Why in the world would we not let on your last days of your life? Why would we not want you allow you to have your religious figure there with you to help comfort you in your death?
Well,
I can't figure out why. That one drives me crazy.
You're starting to sound like a liberal dugger. We've got a prison to run here.
This one drives me absolutely bonkers, and
these people can't be properly screened and vetted. And you got these people. No, tell them what they're liable to try to smuggle in here in the final. We just can't.
But it's an inconsistent stance, though. My challenge is like, okay, fine, if you wanted to make it no for one, then be consistent and make it no for both. But my understanding is both of them are reasonably similar situations, and we allow one but not the other one. And I have my own personal opinion of what the reasoning is, and I don't know if I should go into what that reason is. Then on the heels of that, Texas said no more religious figures in the execution chamber. So they just nipped that in the bud all the way around.
Well, that seems like the thing to do, don't you think, Andy? I mean, you need to get yourself straight.
It prevents the controversy.
Yeah, you need to get yourself straight long before you go to the execution room. If you haven't got everything done by then, it's probably too late.
I'm so bothered by these two things. So we should move on?
You're starting to sound like a liberal pointy head here, trying to please everybody. And what about the victims out there? What did they go through?
They probably went through hell and torture and all that, and I don't discount that one second.
Now, everybody realize I am being devil's advocate
here. I hope
so. I don't actually believe any of that stuff. I believe that a society treats people, even the ones we don't like, that I wish we weren't putting people in execution chambers, but I do believe that we should show a little more compassion as we're putting someone to sleep. But this kind of shows, when I say that we're not a very nice, this shows those states. There were two different states. I think Alabama was one. I forget the other state, but it's not the same state where one gave and one didn't. One provided for the access and one didn't.
Correct. It's two different states, though.
Yeah. So,
but they both appealed it. They both went to the Supreme Court, and one of them was Muslim. That's a key point there. And the other one was Buddhist. So you have one that Americans hate and one that seems to be basically kind of a peaceful thing that no one really has a lot of problems with, even though they've had their challenges in their history too. That's an entirely different conversation, but we just hate Muslims in this country to the point that we will not allow them to have an imam in the execution chamber.
Well, I don't know what to tell you, Andy. Try to avoid execution chambers.
I'm with you. There would be better outcomes if you did things that didn't put you in that line of fire. But
thankfully, my state doesn't have an execution chamber anymore. We repealed the death penalty in 2009. We went from 1960 to 2001 without having an execution. We had one in 2001, and we repealed it in 2009. And I don't see it coming back. So we're not dealing with that. We don't have a death house. And in fact, I just heard one of the correctional worker administrators on a talk show in the last couple of weeks talking about when they did the execution in 2001, since they hadn't done one since 1960, that they had to spend a gob of money to set up for an execution, right, and to learn the protocols. They visited Texas, right, to the state that does the most executions, to learn how to do an execution.
Very strange.
No one was around 41 years later that was around the last time one had been done.
Do you think there would be any support behind a constitutional amendment to ban executions?
I don't think we can get it through any time in our lifetime, because it's such an extraordinary amount of support you have to have. You know, 2/3 of both houses of Congress, 3/4 of the states, 38 states to ratify. There's enough conservative states that, by golly, it's an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I just don't see that you could get to that 38 state threshold if you could get it through Congress.
But on the flip side of that, though, I mean, it's not like we're executing by the single digits per year, give or take. It's not like we do it that often that, you know, it wouldn't be taking that much of an arsenal away from the states.
Well, but that's not the prosecutor's view. The prosecutors that in death penalty states will tell you that it's a negotiating instrument for them. They will tell you, their argument is that without that, to being able to put that on the table, they would never get a plea to life imprisonment. If life imprisonment was the highest penalty,
and
that they would have to negotiate down from there. So they fervently believe that taking the death penalty off the table would undermine their negotiations in capital cases, which are very expensive to put on, because persons either going to go to execution or they're going to go to life prison without parole. So the capital crimes units tend to be better funded in our public defense system. Not say that they're spectacular, but they tend to be better funded.
Well, let's move on to a ProPublica article that probably went all the way over your head through the whole thing. Prosecutors are dropping child porn charges after software tools are questioned. This was neat. I liked reading this one. It's more than a dozen cases were dismissed after defense attorneys asked to examine or raise doubts about computer programs that track illegal images to internet addresses. This is cool. So do you want to ask any questions right up front, since this is in my wheelhouse? I have questions for you from the legal process.
I did do a skim read of it, and I thought it was I thought it was over my head. But from the legal perspective, I can understand that we just can't take the state's prosecutor or his word for everything. But I'd like to hear your perspective first, because it's way over my head.
Well, if for those, like, every computer that gets on the internet, you have what's called an IP address. So a lot of what they're doing in this article, an IP address would be similar to a telephone number. And if I came to your house, Larry, and I used your telephone and I made calls that were, you know, if I was crank calling people and then I leave, well, then someone says, well, we made these phone calls were made from this place. And you're like, I didn't make them, but they were made from your house. Like, that's kind of an undisputed point of it. So a lot of these, like, computer forensic things, they just point you back to an IP address that says this IP address downloaded these nasty images. But when they go and raid the person's house, they don't find the images. I don't know how they would then have a leg to stand on from the criminal case side. They don't have the evidence to back it up. They have, like, an incident occurred, but they don't have an evidence to corroborate that it transacted, that it completed. I don't even know. I can't even really think very much of an analog to compare it to.
They don't have any evidence other than their monitoring says that someone downloaded stuff at that IP address, correct?
Yeah.
Well, so that says somebody at that IP address
has
possessed that information.
You could be sharing your internet with your neighbor and they could be downloading it.
Absolutely. I have an open network, open Wi-Fi at my house, and it helps me to stay under my data limits.
Exactly. So so they know that they're looking for somebody in the immediate 200 feet of the Wi-Fi. But I assume that there are other situations where the defense would challenge what the integrity is of the prosecution's evidence, and they have to then just kind of pull back and retract off of it.
Well, it's secrets that they don't want people to know about how they're doing this, the capacities that they have, because they say that our experts say, well, we say, well, we want to talk to your experts. We want to have our experts look at the your equipment. And, right. And it's the, and of course, that's one of the things that makes prosecution so expensive today, is because everything requires an expert. But that's what I picked up from the article, is that they're folding their tent rather than,
yeah,
for example, stingray technology, which is like a roving, if I understand stingray, mm-hmm. It's like a roving cell tower. It mimics a correct. Cell tower, but it belongs to the police.
Correct.
And the police can go take over your phone, and I'm probably doing a pretty poor job. They can take over your telephone, and you'll be making your phone call through what you think is your carrier, but you're making it through the police, through the stingray device.
Absolutely. That is correct. This is 100% correct.
And we want to know about that stingray. We want to know what it can do, how you got it, who's in charge of it, what its capacities are. We want to take a technical look at it. They don't want us to have a technical look at that thing, whatever it is. That, I have no idea.
But isn't that Fourth Amendment kind of challenges?
Yes, and that's why the prosecutors are folding their tent on some of these charges, because defense attorneys are getting wise and demanding that they disclose for confrontation purposes so that we can have our experts look at that stuff.
And there's even agreements in the software that says that they will not talk about it. It's almost like Fight Club. Don't talk about Fight Club. You don't acknowledge Fight Club. They won't reveal the software is being used. They won't reveal any of the techniques because they don't want the bad guys to know what their process is. But doesn't this immediately then tell all defense attorneys on like the NACDL listserv, hey, just say that you want to challenge the software and all the cases would fold?
If in an ideal world, yes, if everybody knew about, if everybody was tuned in, if everybody had the ability without the fear of retribution of filing the motions and had sympathetic judges who would grant the motions. I mean, you actually have to have a judge who believes in giving the defendant the tools to equalize the fight. When you file a motion saying that I want access to that device, whatever it is, the judge has to give you that access. And when the judge grants the motion, that's usually when the prosecution folds, when they, well, we're like, oh, we dismissed the charges.
They're bullying you to take a plea of some kind, knowing that they're not going to give up the goat.
That's correct. And hopefully as more of this happens and word gets out, there'll be more and more. But attorneys have to actually have time when they're carrying. We've talked about caseloads on a number of podcasts. Yeah. We've talked about horrendous caseloads. And the only way an attorney on the public defense side can get a case to go away is to plead it out. The state can get it to go away by dismissing it. They don't have to break to start with. The judge can hold the state's feet to the fire and make sure they comply with deadlines, and they can shrink caseloads. But the only way a defense attorney can get a case to go away is to plead it out or to go to trial.
Right.
And when they're carrying these horrendous caseloads, ideally they would file those motions. But what happens is when you file those motions, at first it takes time because you have to take a boilerplate motion and tailor it to the unique facts of your client. And then the prosecution is telling you, if you force a hearing on this motion, the plea offer goes away. And if you don't win that motion, so the prosecutor offered your client, I'll give you 10, do 5 if you take the deal. And then you lose the motion. The judge denies your motion, and you don't get the benefit of that. Then the prosecutor says, well, that 10 to 5 is off the table now because your leverage just went away. The big part of your leverage went away when the judge ruled against you. So then the prosecutor says, well, now it's 15 to 10.
Yeah.
So and that's the risk of all this stuff. It's a system that's just fraught with problems.
Yeah.
Despite what you heard when you pledged allegiance to the flag of the United States of America with liberty and justice for all, that's just not the way it is. But that's what you were taught. But that's just not the reality.
From being on the defense side of it, so you know, let's say you get a computer at home, Larry, for the first time, and you fire that mother up, as you say, and you go online and you get infected with something, and you end up downloading all of the inappropriate stuff onto your computer, and you go, oh crap, I shouldn't have this stuff, and you go delete it. Are you guilty of a crime?
some instances, yes, because you possessed it. To delete it, you have to possess it.
And is the act of deleting it illegal?
Well, it could be. You're at that point, you're trying to, what do they call that? They have the catch-all charge that they have for evidence, tampering with evidence. You've tampered with evidence.
What are you supposed to do? Like run down to your sheriff's office and go,
hey? You're supposed to take it down to the police and say, this thing came in by way of a virus, and I want your forensics people to know that I don't have no interest in it, and hope that they actually will not, this may not work also. That's what you're supposed to do.
You are doomed if you do that.
Oh, yes, of course you are.
And I can't imagine that has ever turned out to be positive for any one of our people.
Well, it would be unlikely, but you'd have to have an attorney. You'd have to do it right. But yes, that's...
You'd have to pull like an Edward Snowden and like, you know, plan everything 2 months in advance to submit all the stuff, release all the evidence to the people, and then flee to another country so you can't be extradited.
And then that's going to eventually play out on him, because they'll eventually go find him and bring him home without formal extradition. There's enough people wanting him back, and the courts are crystal clear, and this is really way off topic since you brought us
up. I know it is.
It doesn't
matter. I was just using it as an example.
It doesn't matter, but just for anybody who thinks you might flee and they say you don't have an extradition treaty, it doesn't matter if there's an extradition treaty. If they send bounty hunters in to get you in the middle of the night and they get you back, the courts have said it makes no difference how you get here. If you're here, the question is, do we give you proper due process once you're here? But how you got smuggled in and how you got brought back is irrelevant. So treaty or no treaty, if they can get their hands on Snowden, they'll bring him back.
It's an excellent read, and that article is from ProPublica. This one is from Vibe.
I've never heard of ProPublica.
Oh, really? Oh, they're fantastic. No, they're amazing. I'm sure someone in chat's going to tell me they're too left leaning and, you know, a bunch of gobbledygook or whatever. No, they're fantastic.
Well, I've never heard of them, as they say in the South.
Yeah, I've never heard that expression either until you brought it up.
You've never heard it? Well, you've never watched the Beverly Hillbillies if you haven't heard.
I'm not that old.
Uh-huh.
College student sentenced to over 12 years in prison for rape, but didn't have sex with victim. How do you do that one, Larry? How is that possible?
Well, I don't know that he didn't have sex. I don't know how I read the article word for word, and it was not established that he didn't have sex.
I don't think it's established that he did have sex. They didn't find the right bodily fluids in all the right places.
Well, but that doesn't matter. That you can have sex and not have any evidence of sex.
It was also very quick because, as far as I remember, the video evidence says that they were gone. They entered and exited in about 5 minutes apart.
I've heard of the quickie like that through the years. I've heard that can happen.
I just find it troubling that he claims he didn't do it. There's no evidence so much that he did it. I don't even know that that she said her statement was that much different.
She said that he did it, didn't she?
I don't think she said like I didn't read that she said, no, stop, don't do that. And he went ahead and did it.
But you said that they didn't have sex. But I thought her testimony was that they did have sex.
So, but there's no evidence. There's no corroborating evidence that they did it.
But that
would be the answer.
Okay, but I'll buy that. There's no, but you don't need corroborating evidence.
This is because it's a, I think this is a black kid, right? Isn't this a black guy?
Yes. Yes. He's a young black man. It was a younger, he was 20 at the time. She was 17.
And that's going to be it. I bet you that's what this is really about.
Well, according to the attorney, it said his client, which would have been the accused, misread what was going on. But he doesn't come out and say that they had sex, but that's an inference that they had sex, that he misread it. It's like, well, she said no. But what troubles me is that it's supposed to be a jury of your peers. If you read down at the bottom of the article, it was an all white jury, not a single minority.
Right. And okay. So what's the Supreme Court case that went, God, and I totally, you know, I don't remember the name of it, but there's a certain test, and this happened maybe in the 70s or 80s to where the jury, you can't dismiss a juror for racial reasons. There's a case that went to the Supreme Court.
Yes. And I usually can cite that case, but If there are no jurors on the panel, as long as the prosecutor can't use the peremptory challenges to sanitize the jury to their liking racially. But if they didn't use any peremptory challenges, if there just weren't any blacks because it's an all-white community, then there's not a problem. But for me, it's a problem because the way a black youngster growing up in America would relate to law enforcement in terms of what they would tell them and how they would react is considerably different than how a white kid. The white kids are told that the cop is your friend. You can always trust them and to do the right thing. The black kids are told that you've got to be on great caution about the cops because they're going to tell you to open your trunk when they pull you over for no reason. They're going to ask you where you are, even though you're doing nothing wrong, and what your business is being in this neighborhood. And a young African-American is going to react completely different in a police interrogation because they look at life from a different prism of experience.
There is a picture of a tweet that someone says. It says, "How does the jury convict of rape when a physical vaginal exam was done shortly after alleged crime and showed no DNA, and when surveillance video appears to counter her version that she was stumbling, incoherent, and led away, all white?"
Well, this is going to be one of those cases where the appeal will be based on sufficiency of the evidence, meaning that the jury. The appellate court will be asked. I mean, there may be other errors that the appeals will assert that were made, but one of them, they will argue sufficiency of the evidence. And the question before the appellate court will be, is there any reasonable explanation that the jury could have found this evidence sufficient? If the standard is so high to kick a verdict out on insufficient evidence that you have to conclude that no jury fact finder, doesn't have to be a juror, but no trier of fact looking at that evidence could have found them convicted the person. Well, it does sound like the evidence is very weak, but it doesn't sound like the case is totally lacking in evidence. I mean, if you leave with a person and you disappear for a period of time and you come back, it is possible that something transpired, right?
Yes.
So now, of course, we're supposed to have proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Yes.
But there were bruises, according to of her inner thigh. How did those bruises get there? Mm-hmm. Swabs were collected from the girl the day after the incident from a nurse at a local hospital. The photos of bruises were also taken on her inner thigh. But he initially claimed he didn't remember what happened. And yes, he said that he did that because of his attitude about he doesn't have a fair chance with the police. And I'm telling you, that is a normal reaction from the African-American. They don't believe that the police is their friend and they can trust them to do the right thing. And you just open up and tell them everything. That's not the way it works in the black community.
Right, right. I'm aware of that. They have a very different view of how the criminal justice system works than when you grew up in an affluent community or any level of affluency. Is that a word? Affluency?
I think it is. If it's not, it is on Registry Matters now.
It is now, and it is recorded, and it will be enshrined in perpetuity.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact us at registrymatterscast@treatmentclassaboutus. We want to send out our big heartfelt support for those on the registry. And don't forget to say fuck you people. You fucking matter. You make it possible.
And this article comes from NPR's Justice Department finds violence in Alabama prison common, cruel, and pervasive. I seem to think that the idea of prison is to obviously segment those people from the population. But at the same time, isn't that the prison's responsibility to also protect inmates from each other? This doesn't appear to be happening very well in Alabama and other places too, but this is just where this one's coming from.
Well, I pick on the South, but I am from the South. But the South has long had a history of incarcerating more people as a percentage of its citizens than other states. And the South has been less affluent than they're catching up and have been catching up, but the South has been less affluent. If you look at per capita income, 60s, 70s, 80s, the South tends to run still to the day, but the gap is closed. But supporting prisons is not a high priority. So the southern states clinged, if there's such a word as it clung, they clung to these old.
They clinged it.
They clinged it, yes, like Colonel Clinging, to these old practices of using inmates as labor. You find a lot of plantations and a lot of inmates doing things to generate income for the prisons in the South. And you also find in the South a lot of inmate control over other inmates in terms of the inmates running the prison. Inmates right. participate in running most institutions to some degree in varying levels, unless it's super maximum facility like Florence, Colorado, but inmates participate in running the institution. But in the southern states, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, they tend to have the inmates in charge of a lot of things, in charge of other inmates. And I forget they had a term, it was orderly or something they used to call them. And the point of what I'm getting to is they don't like to spend money on prisons because they've got too many people incarcerated and it costs too darn much money. So right. they end up with very, very poorly run prisons in terms of their facilities, in terms of the quality of their staffing, and in terms of keeping the inmates safe. And it's not a high priority. And this is the Department of Justice under all this work would have been done mostly under the previous administration and under holdovers from the previous administration. They were big on getting into local police operations and analyzing police departments, analyzing prisons. And I suspect that that'll be a lesser priority as this administration replaces more of the career bureaucrats with their own liking. But it is our responsibility as a society, if we're taking away a person's freedom and rendering them incapable of doing anything for themselves, I think we owe it to them to keep them safe. To me, it just kind of makes sense, regardless of what they've done.
There's a quote in the article that says, a federal judge has found horrendously inadequate mental health care and is holding hearings to force the state to stop a rash of inmate suicides. Horrendously inadequate? I mean, what other words could you use to describe to say non-existent effectively?
Well, I think that's pretty strong. Horrendously inadequate. But everyone who's contemplating committing a crime, if there are any people out there, don't do it in the Deep South.
Then that brings up the stupid expression, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime. I mean, like, okay, fine. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff you shouldn't do or you should have thought about before you did it. And then, you know, here, honey, hold my beer, watch this. And that doesn't ever end up very good either.
Well, that particular prison, Holman, has been on. There's the warden of that prison. There's a show that used to go behind. I forget what it's called, but in America's prisons, and I've seen them on TV. And it doesn't look like a nice place you'd want to be.
And what does it say about people of America that we allow this stuff to happen?
Well, it reminds me of a local talk show I was listening to this morning about a prison lawsuit where a jury awarded prisoners $2 million for being left in a hot van for a period of time. And the local talk show host that was filling in this morning, Brandon Vogt, for those of you who might be within the zone of hearing, Brandon Vogt was just poking so much fun about, well, maybe the prisoners ought to thought about what they did that caused them to be in a prisoner transport van. Oh, well, it was so hot that he fell out on the pavement. The guys were passing out. You know, what we've learned is that pets die in heated cars. That when they're stopped for a number of minutes, we've learned that, and we lock people up for left in a car. We've learned that, and we prosecute people for doing that. But in this particular instance, the corrections officials were cleared of any negligence or wrongdoing, that they didn't violate any policies. And the only liability that's being had is on the civil side for the injuries and what they were put through. But the local talk show and the audience who called in and chimed in said that they didn't have any sympathy whatsoever for they should have thought about that before they did the crime. So I suspect if you went down to Alabama and you started polling the citizens of Alabama, I don't think you're going to get a whole lot of people feeling bad about these people that are suffering under these horrendous conditions of inadequate medical, inadequate mental health, not enough space, not enough clothing, inadequate food. They'd say, well, should have thought about that.
Yeah.
Should have thought about that.
Mm-mm-mm. And then moving on to our final article is at a WBEZ Chicago. I've always wanted to say that. Is an article coming out of Illinois. Federal judge finds Illinois rules on sex offenders unconstitutional. And, you know, I guess the short synopsis is people are being held past the end of their dates. And so the lawsuit would be that their constitutional rights are being squished because, hey, you're supposed to get on out on January 1st. And here it is April and you're still locked up because this is for housing reasons that you can't find a place to live on the outside.
That's correct. And let's do a little backpedaling on this. And we're going to link to the opinion. It's 61 pages. And the Illinois people sent it to me with some notes in it. And I've gone through and put some more highlights in it in addition to what they put in.
It'll be in the show notes.
So you have 61 pages to read. And it would be my expectation, as I always say, that this state will file an appeal on this. But it's a beautiful document. I have not read it all. I did a skim read over it goes into all the different plaintiffs and what their situation is. I did a skim read on that. But the important part is we need to understand that don't confuse this with parole. This is in Illinois. They have a system very much like the federal system. In the federal system, you'll be sentenced to 162 months or 112 months or 78 months, and then you'll get your 54 days a year of good time off of that if you don't end up forfeiting that good time. And at the end of that amount of time or a few months before, you will be released, but definitely by the end of that time. There's no such thing as parole. Well, in the state of Illinois, the same thing. There's no such thing as parole in this context. They have a period of mandatory supervised release that follows you after you've served your prison sentence. Now, some states, in Texas, you'll get a period of time where they'll sentence you to 10 years, and after 2 or 3 years, you're eligible for parole. That's meritorious parole.
Okay.
Where you're being granted a meritorious release is different than when you've earned your release by serving every stinking day of your sentence. So what we're talking about here in Illinois is a person who has served every stinking day of their sentence imposed by the court. And then they're going into what's supposed to be a period of mandatory supervised release, but the statute is constructed that they don't get even any credit for the period of supervised release until they're actually being supervised. They don't count the prison. They don't see that as supervision. You're not reporting to a PO. You're not being urine tested very often. You're not having to take polygraph tests, theoretically. You're not complying with work requirements. I mean, it's just not the same as supervision. So these people have paid their debt to society, but they still have to go through a process to get out. And they have to apply and submit residences to the prisoner review board. And then the prisoner review board grants them release. And then the corrections department supervises them. Well, what they're having happening is that none of these addresses are being approved because for some measurement reason, they're too close to something. They have someone living in the home that has a computer and blah, 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 blah. And they never improve anybody. And these people are serving time in prison when they should be on the street. And this is a tragedy. It's happening in other states. It's happening in my state. The only slight difference I see in my state is that we at least give them credit for the time. Once you serve your time and you go into what we call a period of parole, which I wish we'd rename it, at least to be honest about it, it's a period of post-prison supervision. But we have a parole period of 5 to 20 or 5 to life for a few of the offenses. Well, at least on your 5 to 20, you're getting credit for that, unlike Illinois. So theoretically, in my state, if you were under 5 to 20, once you did the 20, they would let you go after you did the 20, even if you did it all behind the bars. In Illinois, they don't start the clock, the way I read this opinion, until you get in the community. So we have that slight advantage. You get to sit here for 20 years. Now, if you're under 5 to life, I guess you would theoretically still be able to be released, but you'd have to go out in a box.
Okay.
Wouldn't that be the only way you'd be eligible if you were doing 5 to life?
Sure. But what I think that you're describing is you get a 10-year sentence and you are 10 years of one day. And to add on to that, you have 5 years of supervision and they're not counting that little gap, that 5-year window as your time still while you're behind bars?
No, you do your 10 years and you stay in if you have not been approved for a resident. Well, in the federal system, that doesn't happen. In the federal system, you will leave. But once you've served out every stinking day, you'll either go to the streets or you'll go to a halfway house, but they will release you in the federal system. Well, in Illinois, they're not releasing you because until you have an acceptable address. So what you have is people who have the means to fund themselves. They are able to live in the community if they can self-fund. The state of Illinois, the good taxpayers there don't see that they want to spend money on housing for people who've committed what they would consider to be heinous crimes. So what you have is a form of the Supreme Court ruled in the case, and it's kind of a Bearden claim, a U.S. Supreme Court decision from decades ago, that the people who have money can get to leave, and the people who don't have money get to stay. And the state's saying, well, it's not really Bearden because we're not charging them any money. I mean, it's just they don't have the money to support themselves. But it's a variation of a Bearden claim, and the judge found two problems with this. There's one that's got to go to trial, and that's the state says that there's an appeal process if they deny your residence. The inmates don't know anything about it, so there's a dispute about whether there's an appellate process if they deny the residence for people to have a due process examination of the denial. That's going to have to go to trial because the parties disagree. But this was decided on motion for summary judgment. Both parties moved for summary judgment, said there was no trial necessary. The judge says, well, actually, there are facts in dispute here because you say that there's a process. State, you tell them there's a process. The inmates are saying there isn't. So we're going to have to figure out if there's a process or not. But keeping people in prison after they've paid their debt to society, you just can't do that in America. I mean, that goes against everything we claim that we stand for.
Does I'm assuming this is an unintended consequences of the left hand and the right hand. So they're giving someone a sentence and they're saying you can't get out without having residence. And then they turn around and they make these crazy, ridiculous residency restrictions that no one can comply with. So there's nowhere for you to go and they can't let you go until you have a place to go. I'm assuming it's not a sinister motivation to say, ha, 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 here's how we're going to keep these people locked up forever. I'm going to assume this.
It's a combination of statutory and departmental imposed policies. Some of those are just standard conditions of probation. We won't let you have access. We won't let you live with a person who has access to a computer if you had a victim who or a computer-related offense. Well, it came out in this 61-page opinion that they actually imposed that on people who didn't have a computer-related offense. So some of this is administrative imposed stuff, and some of this is statute. But the bottom line is that's not the plaintiff's problem. That's not the complaining party's problem. That's the state's problem. If you've got a system where people are served every day and you want them under supervision, you're going to have to find a place. You may have to allocate some tax dollars, but you're going to have to find a place to put these people. That's your problem. And I say the same thing here in my state. We've got to find a place to put these people. We shouldn't have 330 some odd people who have done all their time sitting in prison because they don't have an address. To me, that is unconscionable.
But they're sex offenders, so we don't care.
Well, they're not all sex offenders, but there's a disproportionate number of sex offenders. But there are people who the parole board here denies their addresses that are not sex offenders for various reasons. But we've got to pony up the resources and find it within our compassion to provide housing for people. It may be reintegration centers that would be less desirable to live in than if you had your own place. If you live in a communal situation, you're probably not going to find that as appealing as if you had your own place. So people would probably want to move on through that as quickly as they could.
They would probably find it more appealing than prison.
They would, absolutely. Being in the community where you can get out and take a bus ride, go someplace, try to get a job or get hired, whatever it is they're going to do during the day, that is more appealing than being behind. But I'm saying if you're actually trying to improve your lot in life, you're probably not going to want to live in a communal setting. I've lived on this earth enough decades to know when people are saying the most appealing living situations. I've never heard anybody say, I can't wait to live in the dorms. I can't wait to be in a room with 40 other guys. Have you heard anybody say that?
No. With all the people's laundry hanging out on the ends of the bunks and all that. Yeah. No one says I can't wait to get there.
Yeah. So I have a feeling that even if we provide reintegration centers where we put people in dormitories, I have a suspicion that most of them are going to try to move through that process as quickly as they can.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be cheaper instead of keeping people locked behind the bars to put them in some halfway house situation?
Well, see, that's the debate we have in perpetuity. But the problem is the funding doesn't go with them. It's a philosophical debate. Well, Larry, don't you understand? We can house someone in prison for $30,000 a year, and we can house them in the community for $12,000 a year, or whatever the number is that you want. So right. That's 2/3 less. So as a conservative, you would logically want to go along with that. But the problem is when you take a person out of prison, the $30,000 doesn't go with them right away. The prison continues to have the $30,000.
Yeah. Someone takes the
prison,
spot.
The prison doesn't come in and say, well, you know, we realize that we sure would like to see more of these guys out. So we'd like to cut our budget, move some of this money over to community corrections. So you end up, you have to create a whole new apparatus of community-based corrections, which is on top of the actual hard facilities. It's tough to come in and close these facilities, particularly in rural states like mine, because the whole town depends on the jobs at the prison.
Yeah.
So you're going to build a community center in an urban area like Albuquerque or Las Cruces, and you've got these prisons that are out in the rural, much more rural areas of the state where the jobs would evaporate if you close these prisons. Now, how do you think that's going to play out?
Not
so
very
the money
well.
The money doesn't necessarily go, but yes, it is cheaper theoretically, but in reality, the money stays with the prisons and doesn't.
I have this crazy idea for you. So we duplicate Larry Krasner out of Philadelphia. He stops prosecuting all the people for all of the things and has, you know, just reduces the inflow into the court system, and then on the backside we allocate some funds to build some sort of method to give these people a place to go for some kind of release on time or earlier. And I feel that we would spend less money overall.
Well, I think we would once we did the painful transition of, I mean, they're closing institutions. I think that in Philadelphia, they're closing New York. I think that they either have closed or are about to close Rikers but these transitions are painful to do because people don't want to close down their jobs.
And the public doesn't want to see them released too, because they think that they got a bunch of criminals that are going to come rape and pillage their town.
That's what they're being told.
Mm, 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 mm.
Tidal wave of crime is being turned loose.
That's and that article that we covered out of Philadelphia said there hasn't been very much of a change in the criminality of the city.
I believe that we could reduce penalties dramatically and not have I think that every benefit that comes from prison doesn't take all these lengthy sentences to achieve the goals. There would be some people that were possibly lifetime criminals that you would want to keep confined for a longer period of time. But the first time offender doesn't need the harsh treatment that we give them in this country in most states.
But we continue to dish it out and make it longer and harder. It's awesome.
Well, if you don't like it,
I know.
Yeah, you need to pack up and get out of here.
We could do the podcast from another place. We could do it. I can be on a sailboat in the middle of the Atlantic, and we can still do the podcast.
No, you get treated better than any place else. I'm tired of hearing you gripe. If you just pack up and leave.
Trying to change the world, Larry, one listener at a time. That's what we're trying to do. Larry, how can people find us? How can people find us on the internet?
They can use their search engine and search for it.
And what terms would they search for?
Registry Matters, I think.
You know, Mike said, what was it, 2 weeks ago, he was like, I just loaded up my podcast app and I searched for registry and it showed up. It's like, hey, look, I came up with some good search terms for you. So if you just search for Registry Matters, there it shows up.
Yeah, even registry does it, huh?
It totally just works with registry. I don't think I don't think there's very much else that has registry in there. I know that you like some phone calls. How do people find us on the telephones?
I love those phone calls. We need more of them. One of these days, we're going to learn how to take live calls.
Oh, we could take them. Just don't trust anybody to come on here and be coherent and not talk all funny and all that.
It's 747-227-4477.
And if you know those replay, crazy people that call, you know those people that call into the NARSAW calls and they just ramble and they tell their story for 25 minutes. That's why I don't want to take live phone calls.
I know, and it's always a struggle because even though how many times we say it, they know that their case is the most unusual that has ever been had, and they believe.
Let me tell you a story about how I ended up here, Larry. So when I was born, I got dropped on my head by my mama, and then after that, you're like, "Come on, man, can you ask your question?"
That's how you got here.
That's how I got here. I got dropped on my head.
Uh-huh.
Email address, Larry?
Oh, that would be easy. That's registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Outstanding. And then the best way to support the podcast?
And that's at patreon.com/registrymatters. And thank for the new, what'd you say the name was? Jason?
The new person. Wow, of course you had to ask me like right Jason. There. And I don't, sounds good to me. I don't think anyway, I have the page pulled up anymore. Yep.
We want to get to 100 by the end of the year.
It would be pretty amazing if we could pull that off.
Well, yes, considering we're approaching, we've completed 3 months, so we're fourth of the way through the year.
We are. But that's all I got, Larry, and I very much appreciate all your time as usual. Thank you. And I appreciate the listeners that were joining us in the chat room, and I'll talk to you soon, Larry.
Thanks, everyone, and I'll see you next week.
Take care.
That's the way it is.
That's the way it is. Bye.
And, you're too young to remember that.
No, I know. That's Walter Cronkite. Walter Cronkite.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's the way he signed off.
Absolutely. Later.
All right. Bye.
You've been listening to FYP.